Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today we're listening to the second half of a debate between myself, Dr. J, and Margaret Somerville that occurred at the University of Toronto on August 29th, 2003, sponsored by the magazine Better Humans. And in this half of the debate, this quarter of the debate, we're debating the ethics of life extension with moderator Tim Falconer.
Our next question is, will life extension offer more benefit than harm? This is a tough one for me because, you know, on the one hand, life extension sounds like a pretty good thing. You know, most of us spend our lives in complete dread of our inevitable death. Last fall, I was in this very room, Leon Kass, who's the chair of the American President's Council on Bioethics. He was giving the Alloway lecture, and he spoke very forcefully against life extension, although I have to admit I was not really swayed. At one point, he asked if a tennis player would want to play 25% more games of tennis, since it's suggesting that the answer was a rather obvious no. Well, I haven't really followed tennis since Bjorn Borg retired for the first time. I mean, the fact that Bjorn Borg attempted a rather pathetic return to the game is maybe evidence that he would have liked to play 25% more games. And, you know, for myself, I'd love to play 25% more games of hockey, read 25% more hockey books, or more great novels, and 25%. Well, I like to read any good hockey books, and see 25% more great foreign cities. But where it gets confusing is Kass was using the arguments against immortality, to argue against life extension, and in the Q&A session, Michael Bliss got up and said, well, I think there's been some verbal sleight of hand. What I hope we're going to debate here is not just simple life extension, which obviously has been going on. I mean, all of us have done various things, had operations, appendix removed or whatever, to extend our life, or we're taking high blood pressure pills or whatever. Living a little bit longer is not, I think, what these two want to debate. I think the question they want to talk about is immortality, or, you know, something close to it. And that's where it becomes a bit more contentious. So I'm going to let these two debate that and what the problems are with it. Margaret, it's your turn to go first.
Well, this is the toughest issue to debate. And quite frankly, the transhumanists make the sirens of old look like amateurs. When they sort of start talking about life extension and immortality, because we all want to live for as long as we can, as well as we can, but you know there's some really simple ways to do it. There's been some research reported this week. I don't know, in case you didn't see it, that a glass of red wine each day could increase your lifespan by 30%, and so that's very similar to a very low calorie diet. And I can tell you which one I'd rather have. So that's the first thing. It's right, we've always been engaged in this. The other thing in this particular debate is it's very interesting to look at the language that's used, and language is not neutral. And so the people who are arguing for this radical life extension, they see aging as a disease, they have language of cures for aging, they medicalize aging. That's what I call putting a medical cloak on something, because then we always say, well, the treatment's welcome, doctors do good, medicine does good, it seems a good thing to do. As well, those who argue against them, I've also looked at their language on this, they see opposing radical life extension, and here I'm quoting, the people as champions of death, making the case for the virtues of mortality, deathists, thanatophiles. So we all sound pretty nasty kinds of people out there. So I think one of the things we have to do, and really I think this is where our clash of worldviews comes in between James and me, is do you really believe that there's something inherently good in the natural? And I do. So therefore, I think aging is not just about old age. Aging's a lifelong process. It's a life cycle. And when we talk about prolongation of life, this radical prolongation, it seems from what I've read on this that we're talking about extending every phase of life. So childhood would become, let's just take a figure, 20 years, and adolescence the next 10, and then maybe young adulthood the next 30 or so. And I just can't imagine that we would do that. That would be a radical effect. It would affect the whole of our lives, not just the end of our lives. And I think we have to see the life cycle as a whole with its own shape, and I think we have to respect its natural integrity. It's not just simply pieces strung together. And when I was reading and thinking about that, it occurred to me to think about our theories of human identity and how they've changed, that we used to see ourselves as having an integrated human identity, sort of plus or minus a few pieces through accident or surgery. But today we have what's called a modular theory of human identity. Replaceable parts are us. And so now we can prolong our lives with those replaceable parts, and perhaps radically so. And the sort of impact of overcoming aging for individuals would be, I think there'd be a loss of commitment and engagement. Part of it is that it's a bit like a holiday. You know, if you've only got so long, you enjoy it more intensely. And I think we want to fully live fully human lives. I think aspirations and urgency are important. I also think that renewal, and perhaps in a sense seeing immortality in children, is a very fundamental human response that we would be interfering with. As well, there is some evidence that extending the human lifespan, and certainly age retardation, that causes reduced fertility. So one of the things that we could wonder is whether we'd trade our children's lifespans for part of our own. And I think we would have changed attitudes to death and mortality. And in fact, in reading this, I've done a lot of work in the context of euthanasia, and I really got the feeling that some of this stuff is really an obsession with death more than an obsession with life. And that the immortalists really like the people who want euthanasia, but they choose death. They want to take control, and they talk about death should be a voluntary decision. And so we at least should ask the question, is that a denial of death? And it would change the meaning of the life cycle. We'd lose our moorings of nature, time, and maturity. And I think we could use the term that's actually in the ETC group's book on nanotechnology. They said we have to be careful of impoverishing improvements. And I think that's a very, very useful warning. So the true nature of the debate on this topic is really a clash of worldviews and different concepts those two worldviews adopt of what it means to be humans. I see us as more than mere chemical or biological machines or collections of parts. And natural wholeness is not the same as being a perfect or indeed an immortal being. And perhaps it's our perception of our own imperfections, and mortality is one of those, that gives rise to our deepest longings and greatest accomplishments. And so I think that if we do live in a death-obsessed culture, and this is perhaps the latest manifestation of it, but paradoxically that can make us obsessed with life and the cult of youth, which we see everywhere, but really wisdom depends on detachment from oneself and one's own, although that attachment is also a characteristic of youth. And so, sort of tough as it is, and much as I don't want to die either, mortality makes life matter. And so I think we have to be very careful what we're doing when we're really saying that we would overcome mortality or even a radical life extension. So to some extent, I think that maybe we're seeking to cure the emptiness of life by extending it forever. And the question that all of us ask ourselves at one point is usually, what am I doing here? And the answer to that, the new answer, seems to be to become immortal, or should it still remain as it is, or has always been, to try to do some good while I'm here and to hand on wisdom and goodness? And there's a radical difference between valuing only our own life and also that of the generations to follow. And so I believe that we have to see life not just in the context of ourselves or our own time, but as something that, in itself, life is immortal, even though we aren't, although we could wipe it out, of course. But it's been handed on to us, and we hand it on to others. And I don't think that we should radically change that, much as I'd like to live as well as I can for as long as I can. Thank you.
Ironically, I think you made my point at the end of your talk, which is that it's not, in fact, death that gives life meaning to life. It is what we do in life that gives meaning to life. And there's no reason why an 80-year lifespan or a 200-year lifespan gives any more meaning to life if, as long as we're doing good things and giving more meaning to the lives that we live. I prefer not to speak about immortality for two reasons. One, I believe in the hazard factor, that is that eventually, after a couple thousand years, no matter how perfect our bodies are going to be, there's going to be some kind of accident that'll get you. I also think that the evolution of our personalities over time will become problematic. I can get to that in question and answer. But I'd like to live long enough to achieve that particular kind of enlightenment. And I also, because I'm a Buddhist, and one of the principal ideas in Buddhism is that you become wise when you accept sickness, aging, and death, I've thought about this quite a bit. And what the Buddha didn't say, however, was that you had any responsibility to hurry them along. So I reflect, actually, so although I'm not a Christian or an alcoholic, I reflect on Alcoholic Anonymous' Serenity Prayer, which says, "Grant me the strength to change the things I can, the wisdom to accept the things I can't, the serenity to accept the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference." I think as our powers increase, we will increasingly be able to have healthier bodies and live longer. And so the radical life extension will be an unalloyed good, and I'm quite sure that we will all pursue it. It's like arguing for the plow. I just don't see how it could possibly not come about. The paeans to sickness, aging, and death, it's mostly sour grapes. It's people who think they're not going to be ever able to benefit from these technologies, and so why would anyone possibly want to live to be 80 or 100? What they are completely ignore is, for instance, the fact that over the last century, our life expectancy has increased from 45 years to 75 years. And I don't know any 60-year-olds who are saying, you know, the good old days when I would have died of an infected abscess, that was really the good old days. I have less meaning in my life now that I'm 60, because if I had only died at 45, I would have had so much meaning in my life. We had to adapt. We had to make some serious adaptations as the life expectancy creeped up. We had to build social security systems, pension systems, Medicare. Now we have meddling grandparents telling us how to raise our kids. We have to wait until we're 60 to get our inheritance. There's all kinds of things that are terrible about the life now of having to live until 75. If we then, by the year 2050, have a life expectancy of 120 or perhaps indefinite, we'll need to make other adjustments. We may have to have the basic income system I talked about. We may have to increase the age of retirement. We may have to allow people to go to graduate school until 35, as I did, and increase their adolescence, as you suggested. I'm all for that. It's very interesting, by the way, to pursue a gendered point. There is a lot of evidence that the contemporary feminist movement owes itself to women's extended life expectancy and their reduced fertility, because it created a space in women's lives in which they could pursue something other than the daily tasks of raising children. It gave them the freedom to create and to have consciousness raising and to find other meaning in their life. And I think that that's been a tremendous boon to all of our lives. Now, there are three principles I want to offer quickly for life extension, guiding life extension priorities. One is that an average year of life is as valuable if it's at the same quality, no matter where we add it. If we add it between 20 and 21, if we add it between 80 and 81, if we add it between 120 and 120, 221, it's the same value. Now, people are concerned that it won't be as useful a life, that we'll be, you know, hooked up to machines or whatever. That's an important consideration in our public policy priorities, and we should take that into account. But if we can maintain a consistent, steady quality of life, and most people, no matter how screwed up they get in old age, they still want to stay alive. Most people do not commit suicide. Then I think it's valuable. Everyone should have equal access to life extension technology. It would be grossly, morally unacceptable for the rich to be able to buy an extra 50 or 100 years of life. Right now, if you have health insurance in the United States, you get about an extra 5 years of life. But if it ever gets to the point where radical life extension is possible and it becomes a market commodity, it will be grossly unfair. It has to be available to everyone. And finally, no one should be kept alive against their will. If Leon Cass or Dr. Somerville decide they want to go out the old-fashioned way, whatever that is, that should be their choice. The rest of us should be permitted to decide how and when we die on our own, right?
Well, and what exactly are they proposing? Are they proposing that we shouldn't be allowed to drink wine after the age of 80 because it might extend our lives? Is there some particular technology that we can point to which will be the line between natural life extension and unnatural life extension beyond which thou shalt not go? I just don't understand where that line is or what technology that could possibly be. For instance, nanomedicine, it proposes that we create entirely new red blood cells to carry more oxygen in our blood, so that if I had a heart attack right now, I'd have enough oxygen in my blood from these nanobots that I'd be able to say, I think my heart stopped beating. And I'd be able to walk to the hospital and say, my heart stopped beating, you're going to have to do something about it. Is that unnatural? Does that make me a post-human? Does that rob me of the meaning of my life? I don't see where the line is, okay? So we can talk about what happens if people live for a million years and they lose their personalities and they merge into one big Borg or something like that. But that's not an immediate question for life extension ethics. Thanks.
You're listening to a debate between myself and the bioethicist Margaret Somerville that occurred on August 29th, 2003 at the University of Toronto, sponsored by Better Humans magazine. The complete debate is available from the Change Surfer website and from the Better Humans magazine on CD. Margaret Somerville is considered Canada's leading bioethicist.
Well, just one sort of thing I think we have to be careful about. It's often said that, we used to live to 45, the average life expectancy was 45, and now it's 80, and that's true. But you've got to be very careful with that figure, because once you had reached 5 years of age 100 years ago, you actually had an average life expectancy at least in the 60s and somewhere up to about the 70s. The reason that average figure was so low is because there was such a high rate of infant and early childhood death. So this life expectancy that we've got at the moment is probably around about 10 years or so more than what most people have had throughout their lives. James reminded me of a statement that, and actually some research. We know that we use 50% of all of the healthcare resources that we'll use in our life in the last 6 months of our lives. So the idea is that you should be what they call reasonably well or dead. And then there's a writer in the New England Journal of Medicine called James Fries who wrote an article called Reasonably Well or Dead, Squaring the Curve. So how do you keep people up here reasonably well, then have them go like that? Well, the answer is euthanasia, because that's the fastest way to do it. And in actual fact, euthanasia is a technological response to what I would call the mystery of death. It converts the mystery of death to the problem of death and then gives a technological response. And to some extent, I wonder if this age retardation, life prolongation question. James made it sound very benign and nice, but when you read the literature about what people are talking about, it's like all sorts of enhancement technologies. I mean, we're going to be walking around being more or less sort of some form of cyborg at the least, or perhaps mainly robotic. Certainly if you look at Rodney Brooks's book, Flesh and Machine, he says there's absolutely nothing special about humans and that we'll be better off, more intelligent, better functioning when that's what we become. And so I think this question of the age retardation, life prolongation, is very connected into those possibilities, which I think are quite horrific. And so again, I think we've got to be very careful that I think one of the reasons with respect why the transhumanists put this issue forward is because it is so seductive. That's why I started off with the sirens have got a lot of lessons to learn from the transhumanists, because we all want this and we can all feel that it's good, but we really have to look at what we're getting into, and we have to look at what principles and precedents we're setting up by taking these seemingly small and benign steps to be nice to people and give them some more good years. Fine, but there's other things behind that.
Thank you, James.
I mean, you absolutely are right that one of the basic points that we disagree about is whether people should have the right to control their own lives. And you say a technological approach, a utilitarian approach, or whatnot. I think, in general, the principle, as articulated by John Stuart Mill, is that if you give people the right to control their own lives, they pursue the things that make them happier better than when you tell them what they should be doing. And the two things that give us more control of our own lives are technology and democracy. Liberal democratic rights in a relatively equal society on the one hand, and technological freedom on the other. And what you have told us is that you neither want people to have the right to decide how long that they're going to live using technologies of life extension, nor to decide when they're going to die using technologies of assisted suicide. And I think that people should have both of those technologies and have the right to use both of those technologies in a liberal democratic society. Apparently you think that becoming a cyborg or having a chip in your head or uploading yourself to a computer is the line at which we crossed from the natural to the unnatural. If so, I'm quite happy because I think that there will be many, many technologies which never, which will allow us to have biological continuity of our consciousness and which will not require that kind of uploading, although that will be one of the options. But as I point you back to earlier, I think that one of the basic principles and things that we disagree about is whether consciousness itself is a value, whether self-aware beings are a value. And I don't think that the platform, I think that the argument that staying inside a human quality of our minds or consciousness or personality. And finally, I point you to Brian Stableford's novel recently. I forget the name, but if you look up Brian Stableford's most recent science fiction novel, he's got a character in it who is living for a radically extended lifespan. And he's an historian, and he decides to write a 1,000-year book project, a 10-volume history on the history of death. And the novel goes through the various things that he writes about. And those are the kinds of projects that we will have as our lives expand. We will have projects which give our lives meaning. We will be more committed to the ecology if we're going to be around longer to see the consequences of our actions. We will be more committed to the long-term consequences for our children and for the future generations, because we will be around to be with them, and they will be helping to support us if we actually maintain a retirement system. So I think it's precisely radical life extension which will guarantee us more social responsibility.
But James, so do you think there's anything essential, any essential essence to being human?
No, human is not a category of value for me. It's a person. If you are a self-aware being, who it doesn't make any difference to me whether you are in a great ape, whether you're in a human body, whether you're in a computer. Now, the question of whether how we can actually figure out if things that are in computers or coded in computers are actually self-aware beings, that's a very complicated one. But I think that this, as Peter Singer, we talked about earlier, Peter Singer has argued very cogently that we should be extending human rights to great apes because they exhibit all of the qualities that we consider to be necessary for being a rights-bearing being. At least the right not to be experimented on and the right not to be killed for human pleasure.
Did you know that New Zealand has just done that?
Yes, and I'm absolutely supportive. It's a wonderful law.
Okay, so these two managed to find something to argue about and something to agree about, just about everything. Anybody have a question? Get up to the... Sir, do you want to go to the microphone? Please use the microphones because the TV people who are taping here get really cranky if you don't. Sir.
Yeah, it's a question to both of you. This seems to have taken on a very futuristic tone, and yet I don't think we have to look back too far to... like when I was younger, the age of reproduction seemed to be in the early mid-20s kind of thing. And biologically, the humankind is ready to reproduce in their early teens. Current generation seems to be favoring the mid-30s. The age of pension, 65, was a social study which was to answer the question, by which age are most workers dead? And therefore someone got elected by saying, okay, after 65 we'll give you a pension, and now we view it as a right. So there seems to be an incredible amount of recent activity which has gone towards this rather significant life extension or periods of life being extended, and yet we're focusing on the future rather hypothetically, and it seems to be something that's already here, and I didn't hear much comment on that, so I'd appreciate if you investigated that a bit.
I agree. I think that it's absolutely true that infant mortality was one of the principal causes. But, I mean, again, infant mortality raises this question for me. Why is it, I mean, I promise not to bring up the gay marriage issue, but there are a lot of things about the way that we used to do things in our evolutionary heritage, which we did for a heck of a lot longer than we do them today, which would seem then to be natural. Things like polygamy, like tribal warfare, things like having widespread infant mortality, infanticide, senilicide, things which we no longer consider to be natural. And I just wonder, why is it that not dying at 35, as most of our ancestors, hominid ancestors did, toothless and in great arthritic pain because of all the diseases that we suffered. Why is that not natural? Why is it suddenly natural, the things that happened in the last 400 years or the last 500 years? We are a continually evolving species, and to say that suddenly we have to freeze everything at 1950 as the point at which everything became natural, it's just, it doesn't make sense.
But really the question is, isn't it, whether what we're doing now, or what we've got the potential to do, is different in kind or only different in degree from what we've done before? Because using those prior arguments are only persuasive if what we're doing now is simply an extension of what we did in the past. And I don't think it is. I think it is radically different in kind, what we're now able to do. And that's why we have to think about it differently.
I see it as an extension of fire. So I think it is an extension of things we did in the
past.
But
that's the fundamental difference between the base of our arguments.
Sir?
Yes, you mentioned at the beginning that Margaret Somerville in writing had two values, human life and human spirit, I think you said. And I was wondering if you could expand a bit on what elements run into your development of the concept of human spirit and something about its relevance, especially in this present part of the debate.
Yeah, what I was doing when I was working on this, I was trying to see if in a society that you didn't base on the old external moral authorities that we used, which were God and you know, often through a religion or an absolute monarch who could tell you this is absolutely wrong or this is inherently wrong, could we in a postmodern, democratic, secular, pluralistic, multicultural, secular Western democracy, that's Canada, could we come to some agreement that some things, that some basic things are inherently wrong? And the two principles that I proposed for that were respect for all life, and within that, especially human life, but actually all life, and what I called respect for the human spirit. And the way I defined human spirit, and it was meant to be secular, is it's the intangible, invisible, immeasurable reality that we need to find meaning in life and to make life worth living. It's that deeply intuitive sense of relatedness or connectedness to others, the world, and the universe in which we live. And we transmit that spirit from one generation to the next and from ourselves to our children and our descendants through what's called the societal cultural paradigm, which is a collection of principles, attitudes, values, beliefs, myths that we hand on from generation to generation. And so really one of the things that's happening in this debate tonight is we're arguing about whether that should be radically changed so that instead of primarily valuing the natural and the human and then supporting those with certain technologies, which I have absolutely no problem with, we should really radically alter it to say that we become partly techno creatures. And that's how I see what James is arguing for, that technology plays a radically different role. It becomes a techno-cultural paradigm instead of what I would call a societal culture. It's a societal-cultural paradigm. Or technology plays a much more dramatic, larger, and really different role in that. That human is no longer the primary value and dominant, both physical human and what I'd call the human spirit.
You've been listening to a debate between myself, Dr. J, and Margaret Somerville, Canada's leading bioethicist, that occurred August 29, 2003 at the University of Toronto, sponsored by Better Humans magazine. The debate can be purchased in its entirety from Better Humans at betterhumans.com or can be heard at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. This was the third installment, the installment on life extension ethics. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.